Conversations with the movers and shakers of the Bitcoin world. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We have got an awesome chat today. We've got Max Hillebrand on the show. If you are not following Max, you are failing. He is an absolute beast. Has so much content up on the World Crypto Network and just YouTube and so many different series that he's working on, like tutorials. Has the Bitcoin to the Max show that he does. He's contributed to numerous projects in the space. You can find tons and tons of links and just things to explore on his site, towardsliberty.com. I'll have the link in the show notes and in the Twitter post so that it's easy to find. There's so much to explore up there, particularly if you haven't used some of these privacy tools. Yesterday's episode will actually kind of help lay a little bit of a foundation, because we do talk about Taproot as well as a lot of other stuff. Max does a really good job of explaining what these things are, so it's not necessary, but it, you know, could help out to lay a little bit of groundwork here. But we get into so much awesome stuff on privacy developments, pay-to-end point, atomic swaps, zero-link, CoinJoin. We were straight frolicking down the rabbit hole in this one. This is going to be some good shit, so let's just go ahead and jump into it. And we had some odd microphone issues right at the beginning, so we're actually just, there's not like an official introduction here, we just kind of roll right into it. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into our chat with Max Hillebrand.
Hello? Oh, perfect. Okay.
Hear me? Okay.
Yeah. Do you still hear the frequency coming through?
I don't hear it. It was like a little bit of a before, but I don't think I hear it at all now.
Okay, perfect. Well, then we hacked around it.
We hacked around it. Your phone's freaking out in the background, but at least you got it to shut up, right?
Exactly. Put a gag on him and all right.
All right, so there's a wasabi thing going on. Is this specific to wasabi in Taiwan you got going on?
Yes, so last year the crew met in Lisbon, and back then wasabi was just about to be launched. Mm-hmm. And it was the building on Bitcoin conference there. Okay. And there Lucas Ontivero and Daniel Wolemski and Adam Fiskor, three of the core contributors to wasabi, got together for a while, I think a month in Thailand. And now this year, because the crew grew so much, we were, I think, 8 people here for the first 2 weeks. And now it's for the next 3 weeks still, Nopara, Adam Fiskor, Lucas Ontivero, and David Molnard and myself. And we pretty much just hang out in the cafe all day and get work done, which is awesome. Really just keep on hacking.
Has it been, has Wasabi been slowing down or speeding up? Like you said, you got 8 people now, like all working on this project?
Well, 8 people who were here in Taiwan. Wasabi is free and open source software.
Yeah.
And by now there are probably 100 contributors on the GitHub.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Over like 30 people alone to the documentation. There we have a bunch of contributors, but there is a coordinator company that provides the CoinJoin service called CK Snacks. And this company makes the revenue of the Wasabi CoinJoins. This now employs in total 7 developers full-time, 2 researchers, me being one of them, as well as like the 2 CEOs / lawyers, making sure that we don't get sued. And so in total, 11 people working full time on it.
Wow, that's interesting. How do you where is the coordinator for this technically based off of? Because that seems like a legal risk. I mean, obviously, you said you've got some defense there, but have y'all run into any problems? Do you expect to run into any problems in that realm of things?
Yeah, that was one thing that Adam really wanted to make sure before he started Wasabi, was that he has a solid legal defense to defend against any bullshit coming up. And so he got together with two of his old professors, Balint and Greg, who are lawyers and economists, and they helped him to incorporate in Gibraltar. Main reason for this was that Gibraltar has like a written regulation that as long as you provide a non-custodial service, you do not fall under any incumbent regulation. And because the zero
Wow.
link implementation of Wasabi CoinJoin is non-custodial in the sense that you are always in full control of your own keys, and within the CoinJoin you send to yourself. So it's you know you it's like consolidating to your own hardware wallet. There is no risk for you, right? You never give up control of your keys. And further, because of zero link and bunch of advanced stuff that Wasabi is using, mainly blinded Schnorr signatures, the coordinator cannot even spy on you. So he cannot steal and he cannot spy. He cannot link your inputs to outputs. And that makes Wasabi like more than non-custodial. It really is just a service batching Bitcoin transactions in a privacy and block space efficient way. And therefore, we are pretty solid in the legal defense that we have in Gibraltar.
Awesome. That's pretty amazing. I have to admit that I don't, for the little bit that I've read about some of this, this has really been the one area that I have not dedicated the time to, like understanding the difference between, CoinJoin, Zero Link, there's like four or five of them out there that are variations on the same concept, and like really digging into the specifics of all of these. And Wasabi, you said, uses zero link specifically, right?
Yeah, so CoinJoin is a pretty old idea. I think the very first post was on Bitcoin Talk 2010-ish. And then it was a really old idea. I mean, basically, it's just you want to send a transaction, I want to send a transaction, let's make it together. And that's basically it. You literally join your coins. And there can be a naive implementation that has no privacy benefits whatsoever. And then I think it was 2012. Gregory Maxwell had a talk, a blog, a little post on, a rather long post on Bitcoin Talk, and there he explained exactly what where the problems in Bitcoin are that you can easily follow within a transaction inputs to outputs, so that it might become clear who is sending to whom, or which coin is sent to what address, basically. And he then also said that if we really want to break this, it's not enough to just batch our transactions together. It is vitally important that we create equal value outputs. So that because of these equal values, it is no longer clear, quote unquote, which input funds which output. And in this post, he like was a monumental achievement. And he had in like one little paragraph, he says, oh, and by the way, we could use Schnorr or Charmian blind signatures so that the coordinator of this CoinJoin transaction cannot spy on the users of the CoinJoin transaction. And that was it. And everyone just kind of forgot about it until I think 2015, roughly. Adam Fiskor was like, wait, what is that paragraph about Charmian blind signatures? And that was then what, after many years of research, surmounted into the zero link fungibility framework, which is much more than just the CoinJoin transaction itself. It's like a whole encompassing setup that the entire wallet needs to have from beginning to end, so that it is truly private against any attacker, even assuming that the coordinator himself is malicious, so that the user just can verify for himself it is impossible for the coordinator to spy on.
That's insane. That's crazy that he had kind of theoretically worked out the major kinks just in the initial posts of just like, I think you could probably do this, this, and this. And then 5 years later, it's like, oh shit, we should really be doing this.
Yeah, seriously, and pretty much any idea that you think that you have that is new and novel, go back to
Somebody already
Bitcoin
else
Talk
got
like 2012 and 13. Someone has figured it out.
it. Yep. Oh man. That's crazy, man. This space is so fascinating. Like for somebody who, like day in and day out, excuse me, all I do is read about all this stuff, and And I feel like there is this whole section of the space, like most of what you're doing and like Adam Fisker, and like I follow a handful of you guys just to try to stay up on the tweet version, like this dumbed down, ultra simplified version of what the hell y'all are up to. And I can't, like, I do this all day, every day, and I still can't keep up with it.
Isn't that an awesome feeling to be like, hey, yes. I'm very interested in this. I've really invested a lot of my time, a lot of my brain power into understanding it, and I still have no fucking clue what is going on.
It's like trying to chase the internet, man. It's just too much. All at once.
Exactly.
All right. Well, hell, since we're recording, let's go ahead and jump into this. I might actually use some of this. Let's talk about you for a minute for anybody who doesn't know who you are. And to be perfectly honest, like, you kind of have such a wide area of stuff that you cover and work on that I really kind of have like a vague overview of a lot of the stuff that you do. But I don't know what your real like hardcore focus is. So why don't you cover a little bit about your background and like what you are building, like your business and Bitcoin endeavors right now? What are you working on?
So my main background is in economics, basically. I've always been an entrepreneur and hustling and having like side jobs. And thus the art of human action and allocating resources was always something that has interested me. So pretty early in my life, I started educating myself about this, reading books, reading articles, watching videos about all that. And after first trying out the Keynesian bullshit, I realized that either I'm very stupid and I just don't get it, or the content is absolutely nonsense. And thankfully, I then found Mises.org, and that gave me my real economic education. And ultimately, I stumbled upon Murray Rothbard, whom I owe so much in my economic understanding. And that was all before Bitcoin. So I flew down the Austrian economics rabbit hole, and I had a very decent grasp of monetary economics and entrepreneurship in general, long before I got into Bitcoin. And then after finally deciding to doing some more research on Bitcoin after hearing it every now and then again, I watched my first Andreas Antonopoulos video, the sewer rat, the bubble boy and the sewer rat. And that just blew my mind.
Oh, that was a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was just a phenomenal video. I think to this day, one of his best. And that kicked me down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And ultimately, the cypherpunk rabbit hole in general, trying to learn about how we can use cryptography and just the art of speaking to emerge tools of defense, both for your communication and also now with Bitcoin, for your property in cyberspace. And that has then been more. A lot of my focus, especially in the recent years and months, more on the, let's say, technical side of Bitcoin. Because again, the economic side, I had a decent grasp of it. Of course, Bitcoin challenged all this and made me reassess all of these nuances in economics as well. But the crazy rabbit hole for me really was the cryptography and the tools that we can build with this. And then I started to learn as much as possible and share what I've come to understand. Mm-hmm. So I did many hundred videos on the World Crypto Network about the economics and the cryptography and tools that we have here in Bitcoin. And ultimately,
a real quick question: I'm curious when, like, I always find it fascinating how some people have come, because I'm kind of in your boat that I found Austrian economics and studied it for years, and then somebody dropped Bitcoin in my lap. And I love kind of coming at it from that angle. But were you coding and stuff like before, like leading up to this? Like, when did you start into the whole technical, like, computer code and everything?
Well, like, that's the thing. To this day, I cannot code. I mean, just today I was trying to wrap my head.
Okay, because you work out.
Yeah, it's like I just today I tried to wrap my head around some very basic Bash scripts, and I just failed miserably. So I
assumed you were a coder, because some of the stuff that you, the specifics that you go into and some of the stuff, I just couldn't imagine, like, you know it so well, like from a like an over like how all of these little tools work. So. That's
the thing.
Crazy,
like, yeah. I've learned a bit on how the tools work, and on a high level conceptually, and I get let's say I get the protocol design, but I don't get the specification and the actual implementation.
Okay.
I wouldn't even know where to start for, even in something that I know quite well, like the Wasabi repository. I wouldn't even know where to start on contributing code to it. But conceptually, I really deeply understand how it works. And that's the thing, man. Like, you know, having a good understanding of economics, having a decent understanding of the protocol, I'm an absolute noob in the sense of coding. And it's just that this rabbit hole is so absolutely intense that it is so depth in many areas, and trying to understand all of it is an absolute challenge.
And
I guess more than a lifetime of work.
Yeah. It's fascinating stuff, and it's amazing what like there's such a range of things to get done, and like the design and understanding of these things is so critical that like there's just this whole market between the implementers and the people who are trying to get in. Like it's almost limitless. I mean, the amount of work that you have put out, like I constantly like bump into your stuff and I'm just like, oh shit, it's another Max video or like, you know, tutorial or something that I just kind of stumble upon because I happen to be looking up this stuff. Like your body of work is pretty amazing. How long have you actually been in this space? Like what year roughly did you jump from All Street Economics to holy shit, Bitcoin is now everything for me?
Well, I think that Andreas video was early 2016, so actually not too much.
Wow, you put out some work.
It really was. It took me like a year to, you know, somewhat get used to everything, and you know, of course, dabbled in you know some other stuff than Bitcoin also to just because out of interest. And then it was the user activated soft fork and No2x. In mid to late 2017, that really just made me understand that holy shit, Bitcoin is it. This is legit. And so the day after the UASF, I decided to drop all of my fiat bags and to you know focus my dedication completely on Bitcoin. And then I also started doing videos and doing that for good over a year now. Probably like something like 300 videos or so about you know economics a lot about BISC, about Wasabi, Cold Card, Noddle, you know some more of the protocol design like Schnorr or other Lightning Network. But yeah, that was you know about a year and then seriously contributing to pretty much all of these projects, mainly Noddle and Cold Card and especially Wasabi Wallet. Basically the tools that I use. Like the projects that I really need in my personal day-to-day life, I want them to be good. I want to scratch my own itch. So I want to contribute in any way possible.
That's awesome. That's kind of crazy that, first off, that user activated soft fork was, I find it fascinating how many times that was like a key moment for someone to realize just how powerful this thing was. I mean, it was the most bullish event in Bitcoin history for me. And I find that narrative over and over and over again with so many people that I talk to. It's like, yeah, I was on the fence or didn't quite understand it, but then UASF happened and that whole contention unraveled with the inability for them to change Bitcoin and to see the protocol, to see the network and the market stand up to what appears like from a perspective standpoint was total consensus that we were going to change this thing. Like from the eyes of like, oh, we've got all the important businesses and all the important leaders and all the miners. So everybody else can suck it if y'all don't agree with us. And the fact that they were not able to change it was one of the most powerful demonstrations of what Bitcoin really is, that you can't pretend you have consensus. You either do or you don't.
Exactly. And that was it. It was like the 1-2 punch of the UASF and No2x. The UASF proved to me that if you are a dedicated bunch of individuals trying to change the protocol in accordance to consensus, right, with a soft fork putting something into the protocol that's actually useful and that people are willing to use, right? Like SegWit, for example, it's like beautiful what we can do with it, given mm-hmm. in the soft fork constraints that we have. That was phenomenal. So if you really need something and you don't break the rules, you can do it. It's permissionless. And on the other hand, we have Node2x, that it does not matter how large you are, how much Bitcoin you have, how many, you know, how large your business or enterprise is. If you break the rules, you break the rules. And my node will kick your node out of my network. That just together, stay in consensus and do whatever you want and break consensus and get the fuck out. That was phenomenal.
Why the hell don't you think, what's your like short version of why the hell like kind of the big blocker crew doesn't get that? Like what do you think the big disconnect there is?
Well, I think fundamentally it's a misunderstanding of Bitcoin being a quote unquote payments network, like the base layer where we need to get all the transactions in. Right? If you are a huge company, like Coinbase or other more reputable companies like Zappo, for example, you have tremendous on-chain volume, right? And this has a cost to it, right? Cost being the usage of block space. And when you realize, oh no, the subsidy that pay where the hodlers pay for my usage of block space will decrease over time, that means that I have to directly pay for the block space I use. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh no, my business model no longer makes sense. For example, Satoshi stocks. I just complete nonsense of what we did back then with the usage of block space, just wasting it for random gambling nonsense. And then, of course, you're incentivized to get short-term fixes, right? To get more block space, more resources to waste. And then on the other hand, we have a group understanding that Bitcoin is so much more than that. It's a global network of consensus. It's like a court where you can claim your property rights and prove to a judge or rather to a jury of peers on a network with 100% certainty that assuming that you have the valid proof, you will get the right of moving that UTXO. And that can encompass endless more than quote unquote just payments. And you know, these are just two different views of how we can use this technology. Ultimately, it's permissionless. You can use it in whatever shape or form you want. If you want to do Satoshi styles, do it. Nobody can stop you. But if it's economically unrational, then you will lose money. And sooner or later, your business will go bankrupt and you will no longer have any Satoshis to pay mining.
Yeah, that analogy is probably the best one in my estimation. It's the one that I love and I hang on to, is the idea that like as a mechanism for removing or minimizing trust and creating a incentive and disincentive system for what is the integrity of a digital ledger, like treating it and like having a mental framework of it as a global distributed digital court is one of the best analogies for understanding, I think, both how unbelievably valuable it is and how it should be treated. Because, you know, you don't take a coffee receipt in to get it signed by the judge. It's stupid amounts of overkill to do that for every single payment. But when you are moving your life savings, when you are moving, when you have an agreement with somebody who is with a network that is enabling you to make many, many payments, you want to be able to take that agreement to court should anything go wrong. And it immediately readjusts our mental framework for how to utilize the unbelievable value that Bitcoin. I mean, there's a just now, like in this crazy early stage, and what I think is a horrifically underbought market, like incredibly low value in comparison to what its actual potential is. You get 150 some odd thousand. Dollars worth of protection every 10 minutes. You don't waste that by bloating it with coffee. If it's actually compromising the security and the integrity of that ledger, the ability to authenticate that the rules are in fact followed, makes absolutely no sense to somebody use an analogy that is like carrying your groceries with a forklift. It doesn't line up. Excuse me.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you really come to understand this when you see more advanced technologies, for example, the Lightning Network or other second layer solutions, where you build upon that knowledge that the base layer works, right? That this cord of all the peers in the network actually will always and at any time protect your property rights if you have the sufficient proof. Then you can build upon that to rely on this proof that you might get in the future. And, you know, for example, with these off-chain payment channels, update the property rights definition of a UTXO, of an unspent transaction output, in a way that you don't always have to run to court, but you only go to court if something happens, right? And in most cases, we are cooperative, right? And we will somehow figure it out. And in most cases, we are not malicious trying to steal from each other. But, of course, we always assume that we are malicious trying to steal from each other. And we can do that if we have smart contracts, and I mean like dumb contracts done right, like, for example, the Lightning Network, right? With very basic primitives like multi-signatures and hash time lock contracts, where we can build these elaborate schemes to defend our property rights, building upon that one base layer unspent transaction output, and then having elaborate definitions of who can spend that, and updating these definitions as we go, knowing that at any time we can go to court, we can go back on chain and claim those property rights, then with the consent and in consensus of all other full nodes.
Yeah, it's such a powerful analogy to illustrate what's going on, and it, like, Lightning Network just in general, like, I don't understand. It blows my mind that some people are just not fascinated by it, even in its, like, kind of current, flimsy is not the word, but like iffy reliability stage, but just the very design of it, that you can create just from a basic hash time lock contract, like a standard, like, this is locked for this amount of time, with multi-signature, which are really the only two fundamental tools at play in that contract, that you can create a proof of reserve, insurance, and a punishment clause, an entire little incentive system to, like, make thousands, tens of indefinite numbers of off-chain transactions, and both players are always holding the proof and the undeniable agreement as to who owns what, and cannot be contested. Like, if it is ever taken to the Bitcoin court, like, the rightful owner will always end up with the coins. And that, like, Lightning Network was its own rabbit hole after I discovered Bitcoin. Like, I had never been so fascinated with something post Bitcoin as I was about Bitcoin than when I stumbled upon the Lightning Network. That shit just blew my mind.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that it actually works. That is what still baffles my mind, is that even though we have all these many, many issues with it, I mean, the bolts are a mess, and there are many possible attack vectors. The implementations, you know, are a bit hacky, and many bugs probably in there. But it works. Like, I use it every day. It actually works. And you can actually transfer value. You can transfer the property rights of a Bitcoin off-chain without begging for the consensus of everyone to move your coins. It is quite phenomenal.
Do you use, are you a daily Lightning user like me? I always try to find something to do with it every day just to be like, just to remind myself that it's here and it works. And I love it every time.
You know, it's quite horrific, actually, how much my time preference has decreased with Lightning. And I'm like, oh, it's so much fun. I got to spend some Satoshis. But it's horrible. Like, every time I get the bad feeling that, oh no, like, my great 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 grandchildren in the Citadel are going to be like, what? You spent 10 Satoshis to feed chicken? Are you stupid?
I have fed those damn chickens so many times, and I had nothing else to spend Lightning on. It really has. It has ruined my time preference. It makes me spend Bitcoin, which is the worst thing ever.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, Satoshi's Place was the very first one of these Lightning apps where I was like, damn, this is so much fun. But oh no, how many sats? This is ridiculous. So damn you all Lightning Network developers for building awesome stuff that is actually fun and useful, and for giving me an incentive to dishodl.
Dishodl. Yeah, I think I'm gonna have to cancel all of my my Netflix and my Amazon Prime, just so I can so I have my sats stack, so I'm not dipping into my HODL stash.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing, right? With stacking sats, I mean, the mean is basically just to accumulate capital, and there are two ways to do that. Either decrease your spending, right? You stop buying plastic crap. And a bunch of that. You don't consume as much as you otherwise would. You think ahead of the future, and then you plan long term, and you buy high quality tools that will last you for a lifetime. Right? Then yes, you might have larger expenses in the short term, but because the plastic crap breaks all the time, and actually good tools don't, you don't have to waste money again in the future. Right? So decrease your expenditure. That is one thing that sound money actually teaches you. And on the other hand, it's of course to increase your income, right? To be productive, to help others solve their problems, and then ask them to get paid for being of use to them. That then together, right? To waste less, to be more resourceful, to better take care in allocating your own resources, and then helping others to reduce their resource consumption, so that they will have more capital available in order to pay you for whatever service you provide. That together is what stacking sats is both about, right? To really decrease your time preference.
Yeah, yeah. On that note, do you have like a tipping jar or a donation address or something that I can share out for the, like, with the links to all the insane amount of work that you've put into all this?
Yes, I do. So my personal website is towardsliberty.com, and there are links to, a bunch of Austrian economics and Bitcoin and philosophy. Knowledge, somewhat of a knowledge archive where I share the wisdom that I found insightful. And then there's also links to all the videos that I've produced, as well as in the contact page, I think there's a link to my Tally coin, which was one of the early
Lightning apps. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, though there's like a child of the World Crypto Network, DJ Booth, the developer of that, did that in close collaboration with Matt Bitcoins and myself. And we were using that for a long, long time. To do fundraising, both on chain and on Lightning, also like monthly subscriptions and like perks and Q&A sections and all that was included. It's a phenomenal little app that is very worth checking out.
Nice. I am enter amount. I was just playing around with the. I haven't seen the little tip jar for Tally coin that you've got. On the website. This is actually kind of neat, and I just realized I don't have my phone on me. I was going to send some Lightning like while we were doing this live, but I lost my phone. Okay.
As always, live demos always fail.
Yeah. All right, so I kind of want to get let's start going into the weeds. Before we do, we've kind of talked about the general overview, but I'm curious, in succinct as you can give it, what does Bitcoin mean to you? Like, what's the hardcore why of everything that you're doing?
It's a weapon of self-defense. I have stuff. I want to keep it.
I like that.
I don't want
that
you're able to steal it. And Bitcoin provides exactly that. It's a tool to defend your property rights.
Nice. That's the best. Best short, succinct summary of that, a weapon of self-defense. Are you a 2A person? Are you Second Amendment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you're not allowed to defend yourself against an attacker, you're a slave.
Absolutely. Love it. All right. Now let's dig into some of the stuff. Really, like when I saw this tweet here, I got it brought up. This is what immediately was like, man, I can't believe I haven't had Max on the show. We got to talk about this. There's a whole lot of background to work up to this, but this is what I was like, all right, Max is coming on the show. We're going to figure out how to do this. Was you said pay to endpoint scriptless script atomic swap into a zero link coin join. That is some word salad right there. The P2EP solves the unequal value issue. Okay. So lots to build up to this. First off, I want to talk about CoinJoin. Let's talk about Zero Link and kind of give us a basic overview, and I'll kind of poke at you with some questions as you go through the explanation.
Okay, so the main problem is in Bitcoin, right? That we have a transaction, and this transaction has inputs, which are the coins that you have, right? They are UTXOs, the unspent transaction outputs that you can put into the input of a transaction. And these are the coins you spent, the coins you burn, that you destroy. And on the other side of the transaction, we have outputs. These are the destination addresses of your of where you send the Bitcoin to, the new owners of the Bitcoin, who then in the future can spend these coins in the inputs of their transactions in the future. And with this input and output model, we can have, in some circumstances, a link of who pays whom. For example, if I have exactly 5 Bitcoin, or no, rather, let's say 500 million Satoshis in one Bitcoin UTXO, and I put this into the input of my transaction, and then I send you, Guy, let's say 10 million Satoshis, right? Then
that's cool. You can do that if you want.
Will be quite a couple Satoshis there. Then I put your address, right, with your public key into the output of this transaction, meaning that anyone with knowledge of the private key corresponding to this public key can spend this coin again in the future. And I also do the same with my money that I get back, right? Because remember, I have 500 million Satoshis. I only sent you 10 million Satoshis. So I will get back 490 million Satoshis. And for this, I choose my own public key that I send the money back to me, quote unquote. You always have to destroy the entire Bitcoin, the chunk of money, and you send back to you whatever change you have, right? So in this transaction, we have one input and two outputs. And now we might have some heuristics to find out which of these two is exactly the change output or the destination output. In this sense, it would be the exactly equal 10 million Satoshis, right? Then most certainly, this is going to be a destination address because it is a rounded output, for example. We can apply heuristics like this. And then we have the a bit unequal output value, like the 498 million Satoshis, 779,000, and so on, because of the fee, right? So with some of these heuristics, we can find out what is the destination and what is the change. And with more and more advanced of these heuristics, we can find out which address pays or which coin pays to what address and what goes back into the change. And with a bunch of these assumptions, we can build wallet clusters of who pays whom across time. And that is a big, big problem because this gives attribution to economic trade. And if you have attribution of who pays whom, how much, when and where, then this is a starting point of censorship, right? You can only continue with censorship and aggression if you actually know that something is happening, right? Only if you can attribute can you continue with enforcing something against that individual doing the action. So the goal is to break that.
Real quick, is this kind of why your focus is so strongly on privacy? Is this a censorship issue? Is that privacy is the only way to guarantee censorship resistance in a sense?
Oh yes, absolutely. Okay. Because if you are private, right? If no one sees you stealing something, for example, because nobody saw you, they cannot attribute that you are the one stealing the apple, for example. Mm-hmm. And then nobody can come after you. However, on the other hand, if the owner of the store sees you picking up the apple and putting it into your own pocket without paying properly for this exchange, then he can come and slap you and take the apple back and probably get some retribution as well. So only when he attributes you can he enforce some action. Now, in this case, of course, you were the one violating property rights, so it's good that you get punished. But if you did not violate the property rights of anyone else, then you especially want to have the privacy so that no thug can come and try to steal your money. The thing is, if we have attribution of a act, then we need to have very, very good defense in order to defend ourselves against the attacker who saw us doing the action. Mm-hmm. And we can have, or when we have good privacy, when there is no attribution to our economic trait, then we need less costs in order to defend ourselves, because there are simply less malicious thugs who know that we are engaging in our business, and thus they can no longer figure out that they should attack against us. So the goal of privacy is to reduce the cost of defense, and that is why it is so vitally important.
Gotcha. Okay. And that really is kind of one of the amazing aspects of cryptography, is that, because defense has always been, I'm veering a little bit here, but defense has always been like a thing where it always takes vast amounts more energy to build a wall, like more energy and coordination to build a strong wall around something than it takes to break that wall down. But cryptography kind of has a different dynamic, is that like if you're protecting the nature of that random number, essentially, that you're defending your information with, it takes possibly an unlimited, a practically infinite amount of resources when we're talking about from the context of a human life and the scope in which you can get attacked, in order to tear down that encryption wall, to tear down the randomness that protects your data. And it's fascinating that we can utilize that new dynamic in such a broad range. It's like one fundamental tool that can be applied so incredibly and beautifully in so many different ways.
Oh yes, absolutely. Right. And Bitcoin builds upon this asymmetric key cryptography. And it's trivially easy to create a public key and derive a private, to create a private key and derive a public key out of this. Trivially easy. You can do that by flipping a coin, and your computer can do it millions of times a second, basically. However, it is exponentially and truly exponentially more difficult to try to guess or to derive the public key if all you have the private key if all you have is the public key. And Bitcoin builds upon this, right? If you have a securely generated private key and you derive a public key out of that, and you send coins towards that public key, then it is absolutely pretty much impossible, we can say that, for someone else to guess your private key, to figure that out, and to then, provide proof of knowledge of that. And that is already fantastic, right? But what happens if all of a sudden no longer this, private public key cryptography applies to your threat model, right? For example, if you leak a bunch of your personal information and you are no longer private, and an attacker knows exactly that you personally, Guy Swan, has a bunch of Bitcoin, right? Then he will come knocking at your door and apply the $5 wrench attack, and you are most likely going to give him your private key. And then it does not matter how much bit entropy you have in your private key. If you are being hit with a $5 wrench, and especially if your family and loved ones are being hit, then you are going to give that up, right? And this is then where privacy comes in, to further strengthen this defense, so that actually the private public key cryptography that Bitcoin is built upon, it, that it actually works, that this is that is sufficient to defend you in all encompassing attack.
Nice. I think we should change the Second Amendment to be like the right to bear arms and the right to bear Bitcoin in self defense. Okay. Zero Link. Let's head back to Zero Link. I kind of dodged. Tangented a little bit there. How exactly does Zero Link work separate from, so the basic idea of CoinJoin is just we're putting these transactions together, right? That multiple people are doing these transactions. Let's put them all in one set of inputs and outputs. What makes it Zero Link versus just combining transactions together?
Yes. So Zero Link here applies specifically to the coordinator. The guy who puts together the inputs and outputs, who writes them on the piece of paper, basically, and sends it to everyone for signing, he must not be able to find a link between who owns the input and who owns the output, right? That is the zero link part. Even the coordinator cannot attribute which input, quote unquote, pays which output. And we do that with, anonymous communication. So, for example, you can use the Tor network with several Tor identities. For example, your Wasabi wallet has three Tor identities at any given time running in parallel, and they're not connected to each other. So your full node, or sorry, your Wasabi communicates with the coordinator in a way that the coordinator does not know that all of this communication comes from the same Wasabi wallet. And in the first round of communication, you tell the coordinator with the Tor identity called Alice in the protocol, you tell him, hey, this is my input, and you provide a signature of a challenge message, so the coordinator has cryptographic proof that this is actually the input of Alice. And let's say Alice has 5 Bitcoin, right? And then also, she provides a change output address. And this is a regular clear text Bitcoin address where she will get the change back. And this is provided by Alice unencrypted. So the coordinator can clearly see, okay, this is the input of Alice, and she wants to get the change back to this address. Let's say 4 Bitcoin, just to have the round numbers. Here again, there is attribution between the input and the change output, right? So there's no privacy for the change output. That is because it's not an equal value, right? And as Maxwell pointed out in his original post, only equal value coin joins provide decent privacy, and unequal value coin joins do not. It's very trivial with the coin join Sudoku to find out which input pays which output if you don't have exactly equal value outputs. However, Alice also provides another address, and this address is blinded to the public key of the public key of Alice, and this is done with Schnorr blind signatures. Honestly, I have no clue exactly how the details work here. It's crazy complicated, but it works. Basically,
I want to interrupt real quick. So this is a blind address of Alice's, and this is where change address is going. Is that right?
No, for the blinded output address, there goes the equal value output, because for this one, actually want to have the privacy, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So what Alice does is she knows her public address, and she blinds it, basically generating ciphertext, just random gibberish that is completely unintelligible. Mm-hmm. And she sends this ciphertext, this blinded output, to the coordinator. And the coordinator then checks, is the input valid? Is the change output valid? Are all the things in the protocol valid? And if they are, then he will sign this blinded output address. So he does not know exactly what he is signing, right? Because it is ciphertext, it's blinded. Mm-hmm. But because of the magic of blind signatures, when he sends it back to Alice, Alice can unblind this blinded signed output address. And magically, on the clear text itself, it shows the coordinator's signature. So Alice here has an address that is hers, and she has cryptographic proof that the coordinator has signed it. And the coordinator only signs it if the inputs are valid and if the outputs are smaller than the value of the inputs. Alice is not going to steal money.
Gotcha.
So this is the first round of communication.
Okay, so let me kind of sum up what I've gotten out of this here. So Alice, in this context, the way the blind signature works is that she takes her valid information, the address that she knows that she's sending these coins to, and mixes it with just something to blind it, to make the information itself indiscernible, but she can send it to the coordinator. They can sign this knowing that as long as the inputs and the outputs are fine, they don't have to know where the address is. And because they're signing everything with equal value outputs, then it's distinguishable from everything else they're signing. They just need to make sure the accounting is right. And then when they send it back, Alice takes out that ingredient that she put in to make it confusing at the beginning. And then out of that, she still has a valid signature left over with the information that she knew at the beginning.
Very well explained, absolutely. Okay. Maybe a nice analogy for this is, Alice has a piece of paper, right? That is her address, and that is just a regular piece of paper, anyone can read it. She puts it into an envelope and seals it, right? So this envelope no longer shows what is exactly inside. And she gives this envelope to the coordinator. He does all the checks that he needs to. And ultimately, if everything is valid, he will sign on top of the sealed envelope. Right? He still does not know what is inside the envelope. But with the magic of the specific ink that he's using, the ink starts dripping through the envelope and the signature is inside the paper itself. And then Alice can unseal that envelope, and the paper that she takes out with her address also still has the signature of the coordinator.
So it's kind of like a carbon paper signature where all the important details are on the second page. Like, so the signer never actually sees it. I like that the ink bleeds through.
Precisely, yes.
All right, let's take a break real quick, hit our sponsor, and we'll jump right back in.
And then we can move on to the second round of communication. And that, very importantly, is done with a different Tor identity. And the protocol, it's called Bob, right? And so Bob is, on the network level, not connected to Alice at all. Completely new Tor public keys and all this. So the coordinator, when communicating to Bob, does not know that it's the same wallet that has that specific Alice. And this Bob identity then will send to the coordinator the unblinded, signed, equal value coin join output. So basically, the sheet of paper that has the address and the signature of the coordinator. And as soon as Bob has sent that, he will disconnect from the coordinator. And now the coordinator sees, okay, here's an address, and this address has or should get the value of exactly one Bitcoin and exactly 1.000 Bitcoin. And he also sees, oh, here's my signature on this address. So he knows that at an earlier point of time, with a random Alice that he cannot attribute to this Bob, that he has proved that all the inputs are valid, that Alice does not try to steal money, and so on and so on. So he can prove that this output address is a correct one and that is eligible for funding in the CoinJoin.
Okay, that's interesting. So you actually have multiple identities for the multiple stages in coordinating this. And that after Alice, in this sense, gets the carbon paper or the envelope signed with the ink through, then she opens it up and then sends just the, takes on a new identity, essentially, and sends just the outputs back to the coordinator, which is in aggregate from all the other people sending outputs. And this is then signed. The coordinator knows that, okay, yeah, I signed this information, but he has absolutely no idea which of the many envelopes he was handed that that output actually comes from, because it's not connected to the input or the identity that sent the inputs. That's fascinating.
Exactly. And that is where the zero link comes in. Even the coordinator cannot link inputs to outputs. And that is why it's so absolutely important that you have, for example, the Tor network communication, or you know, other more nuanced things like that the coordinator must not know the extended public key of the user, right? Because if he knows exactly the extended public key and therefore all the public keys of the user, then it's easy to link Alice and Bob. So, you know, there are many nuances that you have to implement here so that there is truly no link between input and output of the coordinator. And that is why Zero Link is a fungibility framework. It's not just a CoinJoin implementation. It's an all-encompassing thing that you really have to take great care at implementing.
Interesting. So, and I have a question about like this final CoinJoin transaction. Is that like how do like you have to have the public key or the signature of each of the individual participants for the input? Is there like when we apply this to Schnorr signature, or when we apply Schnorr signatures to this, everybody talks about and has gone into the variations on how Schnorr can essentially combine public keys into one. Will it be possible for this CoinJoin transaction to eventually, after all the kinks and implementations are worked out, essentially have one public key signing for the entire list of inputs and outputs, even for the many parties involved?
That is theoretically possible with something called cross-input signature aggregation. And that basically means that we have several public keys in every single input. And for example, in the Wasabi Zero Link transaction, there are 200 inputs, probably even more, in one single transaction. So we have 200 individual public keys. We can aggregate them to be one. We do not aggregate the public keys. But what we do is we produce a signature in a multi-step communication round so that there is only one signature for all the many public keys. And this one signature is only valid, cryptographically only valid, if all the private keys of all the many, many public keys have signed that same message.
Gotcha.
And the beautiful thing here is that this means we have many inputs and only one signature. And this means that every input does not pay for his own signature or does not use block space for his own signature, but that he uses a part of a signature that he shares with all the other inputs. So it is a very, very cheap way of transacting Bitcoin. However, on the other hand, that is something that will not be introduced in the first implementation of Schnorr signature called Taproot. Mm-hmm. This will take another many, many 2 weeks, probably like 5 years, 10 years before we have that in the protocol.
Gotcha, gotcha. Will that require a further soft fork from Schnorr? Will it be an implementation that's possible, just a lot to work out after Schnorr gets implemented?
Yes, so we need Schnorr signatures to do this. And it is possible to do cross-input signature aggregation with a consensus soft fork. However, it touches a lot of consensus code. So it is very, very complex. It will require a lot of research, a lot of implementation care, and especially a lot of peer review that we don't fuck it up because it is very, very, very tricky.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. And kind of the major issue there is that it's a pretty significant coordination issue, I guess you could say, that like all 200 have to sign essentially in, I guess, in tandem, and that if anybody tries to put invalid data or whatever, it just kind of screws up the entire stack of communication that has gone on to make that work out.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. And the thing is that already Zero Link is very, very tricky to communicate. We have many rounds of communication amongst hundreds of peers all over Tor with several different Tor instances. It turned out that in Wasabi in the early days, the biggest bottleneck was Tor. Like a year ago or so, we were stuck at 12 peers in a CoinJoin round, an anonymity set of 12.
Oh, wow.
Because the Tor connection broke. So people could no longer sign because they lost the connection along the way. And if you cannot sign the transaction in the final step, then, of course, it has to be abandoned and redone all over again. So Tor was a huge bottleneck until we implemented Tor ourselves in the nBitcoin library and now running our own Tor instance. Now we've kind of fixed this. And we can get rounds of over 100 peers joining, but it is still very, very difficult to coordinate all this in a way that you don't leak any privacy.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't realize there was the implementation in Tor, and so it was actually implemented just in the nBitcoin library, and like you're essentially like Wasabi's running its own Tor, like within. Like the client and like the communication of all the peers?
Yes, exactly. And the cool thing, that is just the beauty of open source or free software development, is that there is a library called nBitcoin, which was developed by Nicolas Durier and Adam Fiskor and many other contributors by now. And this library implements all the crazy magic that Bitcoin needs in order to work. And it is used by two awesome projects, one being BTC Pay Server and the other being Wasabi Wallet. Both of them are developed in C# as well as nBitcoin. So we had issues with Tor and Wasabi Wallet. So we sat together with Nicolas Durier and be like, how can we fix this? And we ended up implementing in nBitcoin a Tor instance or like all the backend that we need. And now both BTC Pay Server and Wasabi use the combined work and effort that we put into nBitcoin with this Tor library to now run both BTC Pay and Wasabi's Tor with a inbuilt tailor-made solution.
God, I feel so ignorant right now. I haven't played. There's so much of this stuff that I haven't played with yet. I don't understand. I'm still not running BTC Pay Server. I feel like there is this whole side of all of this stuff that has been going on that I have somehow missed in the mountain of stuff that I have been chasing in Bitcoin. This is crazy. Okay. All right. So we got the basic idea of zero link. We've got a big coordination going on, running our own instance of Tor. Now we know how to mix coins, and we end up with a bunch of outputs of the same amount, which is, 0.01 Bitcoin or 0.001 Bitcoin, whatever it is. Everybody ends up with those outputs. Now, what is pay to end point, and how does that play in this? This, as I understand, is another one of those like opcodes that will be like the Schnorr and Taproot soft fork. Pay to end point is one of those additions. What does it mean, and how is it different from the current setup?
So pay to endpoint is another CoinJoin implementation, and it's very brilliant, actually. And it got out of a kind of hackathon / brainstorming session with a bunch of Bitcoin wizards, including, by the way, Adam Fiskor, who people like Adam Back, Gregory Maxwell, Peter Woolley, Jonas Nick, many others. Who got together for a couple days, and this was one of the concepts that they worked on, as well as reviewing, by the way, Zerolink. And the trick, so a pay-to-endpoint does not have anything to do with Schnorr. As a matter of fact, you can actually use it already today, and there are working implementations of it.
Oh, wow, I didn't know this. Okay.
And it's a way of doing a coin join and getting privacy without relying on equal value outputs. So again, a coin join is literally only we join our coins, right? You have coins, I have coins, we put them together in a transaction. Multiple peers doing transaction batching, basically. And the use case for this is if we have a user buying his coffee at a merchant, and we want to hide the fact how much value is actually being transferred. So if the coffee costs one Bitcoin, we want to hide that one Bitcoin was actually transferred in this economic exchange. And we also want, if we hide exactly how much value is being exchanged, we also hide what is the destination and what is the receiving address. Mm-hmm. And that is what pay-to-endpoint does. And it's a two-peer coin join, basically.
Okay. Okay. I know what pay-to-endpoint is. That's when you put your basically... like I'm paying the or I'm paying you, and make this simple, we basically, like, you have your own transaction or whatever that you're trying to do with your change output, and we basically just like, all right, well, let's just put these together while I pay you, and then you don't know exactly which is it. Do I have that right?
So basically, right, if you want coffee and I'm a barista and have the delicious brew,
yes,
then you have a one Bitcoin or you have a three Bitcoin UTXO, okay, and you want to give me one Bitcoin of that UTXO, then you would construct a transaction that has your three Bitcoins in the input, mm-hmm, that has my address with the one Bitcoin in the output, and your change address of two Bitcoin in the output as well, right? So a one input, two output transaction.
Yeah.
And you sign this transaction, it's ready to go. It could be broadcasted to the network at any time. However, then you tell me, hey, we could do a pay to endpoint coin join here as well. Do you want to? And then I, as the merchant giving you the coffee, can be like, yes, okay, let's do it. And for example, then I have a five Bitcoin UTXO and I want to coin join with you, who has the three Bitcoin UTXO, my five Bitcoin UTXO as well. So we build a new transaction that has your three Bitcoin and my five Bitcoin in the inputs, right? Mm-hmm. And you will get your change back. That is still two Bitcoin, right? And I will get one Bitcoin from you. However, I will also get my five Bitcoins back, right? Because it's my money and I don't want to send to you I just want to send back to myself. So we have two inputs, 3 Bitcoin from you, 5 Bitcoin from me, and 2 outputs, 2 Bitcoin change to you and 6 Bitcoin back to me. And as you see, on the transaction level, the 1 Bitcoin is nowhere to be seen, right? It is 6 and 2 Bitcoin.
Okay. Yeah.
And with this very brilliant trick, we hide which output or which value is being transacted in this economic trade.
Okay. And at the same time, you get to, like, your benefit is that you now have 1 UTXO of 6 Bitcoin instead of 5 with 1 added that you have to aggregate later in a transaction. You basically aggregate early when we're combining these together. So you get the benefit of a smaller transaction later on, and we both get privacy, and there's no clear payment because it's both just, quote unquote, the change for either of us, and we're not linked to specifically which one is which. It could be either one of ours.
Yes, exactly. That is one of the brilliant aspects of pay to endpoint, is that the merchant consolidates his coins. So it is actually also a scalability solution, because he can consolidate within that one transaction, and he does not need to do a second transaction afterwards. So we decrease the number of UTXOs, we decrease the number of transactions. And that is both very, very important for scalability.
Wow. Okay. And it's a form of, that's really amazing that it's a form of, like, miniature ongoing consolidation for data on the chain, which is critically important. I would love to see something like that just be kind of like a default standard, just for the means of aggregating UTXOs, just to kind of compress the amount of data that we need to deal with on chain. That's really interesting.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense to have this for pretty much any merchant. There are some downsides. For example, the merchant reveals to the user that, hey, these 5 Bitcoin are mine, right? Yeah. And you could abort the protocol and end up finding out that the merchant has 5 Bitcoin without actually doing the coin join afterwards. So there are some edge cases like this, and as well just, you know, a user experience flow. All of a sudden, you have multiple transactions. The user has to sign 2 different transactions. You have to be careful to not broadcast the wrong transaction. How do you communicate such a multi-step process? You know, there are many, many nuances in the implementation. The devil is in the detail, as with all of these rather complex things. But ultimately, on a conceptual point of view, it's very brilliant.
Nice. All right. So now we've got Zero Link. We've got pay to endpoint. Let's talk about scriptless scripts, because this is something that I've watched a lot of stuff on and have listened to, and I still feel like it's just a vague idea in my mind. What can you kind of enlighten about scriptless scripts and exactly what the hell that means?
So the scriptless script basically means exactly what it says in the word. It has functionalities of a script without actually using Bitcoin script. So Bitcoin script is the operational programming language that Bitcoin Core use, or the Bitcoin network uses. For example, a public key is a Bitcoin script. It says only who can prove the knowledge of the private key with a signature can spend the coin of this public key. Right? That's a Bitcoin script. It's a objectsig verify. Then a multi-signature is also a script. You can say there are 3 public keys, but you need to have 2 signatures in order to spend that coin. That's a 2 of 3 multisig. That's another script. One of the very useful opcodes is something called it's a hashed time locked contract, basically using check sequence verify as the opcode. And with this very brilliant script, we can have the functionality that we commit, or that we have a secret in the sense of a HTLC. We have just a pre-image, what is called, and we commit to the secret by hashing the secret. So when we know the hash, we can no longer change the secret, because every different secret, every different message has a different hash. So we have a secret, that is the pre-image. We commit to the secret, that is the hash of the pre-image. Then we do something with that commitment. For example, in the Lightning Network, right, we build a onion route through the network with this commitment of the secret. And then at a later point in time, we reveal that secret and something happens. For example, in Lightning Network, everyone gets paid along that route. So that is the very basic concept of HTLCs. You have a secret, you commit to it, you do something with that commitment, later you reveal the secret, and something else happens.
Okay. Okay. And with how does that apply exactly to scriptless scripts? Like, what's the relationship there?
So there is something where we can use the power of Schnorr signatures to have the same functionality as hash time lock contracts without using hashes at all. Because the problem is, hashes are different than public keys and signatures, right? They look different. They are longer. They you cannot provide a signature. You can only reveal the hash pre-image. And with public keys and signatures, we can tweak them in cryptographically very bizarre, awesome, magic way, so that we have a secret, and we add this secret to our public key, and this generates a tweaked public key, and the cool thing is that this tweaked public key looks exactly the same as any other public key. It's just a random number. And we can add the same secret called the adapter to our private key. And then we have a new tweaked private key that is basically just the starting private key plus the tweak, the adapter. And then we have a public key that commits to a secret. Right, it's a tweaked public key that has the secret, the adapter, hidden within. And this is the commitment. And later, we can provide a signature with the tweaked private key, and this signature reveals the secret in it of itself. And this is the revelation of the secret. So fundamentally, we have the same concept as with HTLCs. We have a secret, the adapter. We commit to the secret by tweaking the starting public key with the secret, creating the commitment, which is the tweaked public key. And at a later point in time, we can reveal the secret by producing a signature with our tweaked private key.
Okay. So like in the context of scriptless scripts, this is very like kind of the fundamental stuff about Taproot that I went into on yesterday's episode is that like we are tweaking the public key rather than using a hash of it, like the hash of the script, because with the hash, we eventually have to actually reveal the script. But in the sense, in the example that you're talking about, the adapter or the tweak itself is actually the script. So what we're doing is we're just making the script part of the actual public key so that we can sign with it privately without ever actually telling the chain what the script was. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
In general, yes. So we use the same tweaking both in scriptless script and in Taproot. We simply add numbers together, right? The public key is a number, secret is a number. We do public key plus secret. And that gives us the tweaked public key, another large number. So that concept is the same for both scriptless scripts and Taproot. But the difference is a bit in how do we reveal the secret. For example, and what the secret is, right? In Taproot, as you said on last show, the tweak in and of itself is a hash of the Merkle tree of all the different spending conditions that we have in the tap tree. And we can add this hash, just a random number, to the public key in and of itself, thus committing to the to this entire tree of scripts. And we can later prove to the Bitcoin network by making a transaction spending one of these scripts that this particular script was part of the tap tree, which was committed to in the public key. And that is how we can use tweaking in Taproot. But for scriptless scripts, in and of itself, in the sense that I'm talking about in this tweet, it's a bit different.
All right, so let's put all this together now. So you've got this. This was the original tweet that got me really excited. So pay to endpoint, scriptless script, atomic swap into a zero link coin join. So we've got a combined transaction with somebody that we're doing an atomic swap with, and we are hiding the script by using essentially a blind signature on that data, like we're using the hash of it instead to sign with, and we're moving into a zero link. Kind of break down that process and what we're actually gaining, all the things, all the benefits that come from that.
Yes, that is something that I really am more excited about than coin joins, is coin swaps. And with coin swaps, atomic coin swaps, we usually think of like changing Bitcoin to some shitcoin. because that is, so far, that has always been the use case for atomic swaps. But actually, I think that atomic swaps are such a unbelievably powerful privacy tool that have greater potential than coin joins. So because basically a coin join breaks the link from input to output within one single transaction, right? With zero link, we have a huge transaction with many hundreds of inputs and hundreds of equal value outputs plus change. And we can no longer say which input, quote unquote, pays which equal value output. So we break the link between inputs to outputs, but it's still within one transaction. And we still know that the input of this transaction pays the output of the transaction. We don't know which input pays which output, but we know that it pays some output within the same transaction. And this means that our anonymity set, the crowd that we hide in, is only all the outputs of this transaction. Now, with a UTXO swap, with an atomic coin swap, what we do is that we break this link, not just within one transaction, but across several transactions, meaning that Alice has the input in the transaction one, and she gets the output in transaction two. And Bob has the input of transaction two, but gets the output of transaction one.
Oh, interesting. So you atomic swap across different transactions during this process.
Exactly. So let's assume in a like very, very common use case that Alice goes to Coinbase and she begs for permission to buy her Bitcoin and thus has to reveal her government identity and all this, right, to then dox herself completely. And so there is clear attribution that Alice has Bitcoin. And because of the way that UTXOs work, it can be clear what she does with them afterwards, right? We can follow the chain. And she could use, for example, a zero-link coin join to break what she does after the coin join. But in this sense, Coinbase still knows that Alice was part of the coin join in and of itself, because she sees that Alice's coin is registered in this coin join. And so with atomic swaps, what we can do is that Alice talks to Bob and she says, hey, Bob, let's swap our coins. So that Alice puts her coins into a Taproot output that has at the base a 2 of 2 MuSig. So it's a coin that can be spent only by Alice and Bob together. But she also uses the scriptless script magic so that Bob can spend that coin if he has a secret from Alice. Right? It's the same as with HTLCs. Alice commits to the secret in this public key, and then if Bob gets that secret, he can spend the coin without the signature from Alice, right? He gets the hash pre-image of the HTLC, basically. And then in a second, completely different transaction, Bob provides his coin in the input, And he generates also a 2 of 2 MUSIC Taproot base layer with the adapter secret so that Alice can spend the coin with her signature and a secret of Bob. If Bob constructs that second output of the second transaction in a way that Alice can spend that second coin, right? She can claim the output of that second transaction. But if she claims the output of that second transaction, the only way that she can do it is by revealing the secret that Bob needs in order to spend the coin of the first setup transaction by Alice.
Gotcha. Okay. So basically, in a sense, what's happening is that it's being locked up with a secret, like both separate coins are being locked up with a secret where if, let's say Alice is trying to get the atomic swap, as soon as she has the secret and uses it to redeem her coin that she got from Bob, it reveals the exact same thing that allows Bob to take his coin. So it's a situation where either both get their coins or nobody gets their coins, because the secret is made public when it gets unlocked, right?
Yes, exactly. Though with a little minor tweak, and that is where the beauty of using Schnorr adapter signature compared to hash time lock contract comes in. Because with hash time lock contracts, what we put on chain is the hash itself, right? The commitment of the secret. And then later, if Alice wants to claim that second transaction output, she will put the hash pre-image onto the chain as well. So Bob and all other full nodes will see that this is a hash pre-image, right? And they'll know that's
the difference. Okay, yeah.
Exactly. So everyone will find out that this hash pre-image of the second transaction is later used by Bob in order to claim the coin of the first transaction, right? Bob will use the pre-image of Alice from the second transaction to take his coin in the first transaction. And there is a clear link between the two transactions, right? Because it's hash and pre-image, everyone can easily calculate that.
Yeah, both of them can see that they're the same.
Exactly. So we don't really get any privacy, right? Because we see, this was just two people swapping their coins. And now Alice no longer has the coin of the first transaction. She got the second transaction coin. Mm-hmm. However, with scriptless scripts, everything looks like a public key and a signature. And the adapter itself, the secret that Alice reveals, she does not reveal on chain in the form of a hash pre-image. She reveals it in form of a signature. And even better, only Bob can calculate the exact secret that he needs. And for any outside observer, there is no secret. It is just the public key and signature. They don't even know that there is a script. And even if they know that there is a script, they cannot calculate the secret and thus link the two transactions.
That's insane. I never really thought about the fact that just using Taproot or just using scriptless scripts, like using this method, like totally just makes atomic swaps invisible on the network. I didn't even really think about that, but it does.
Precisely. It makes it invisible. And the cool thing is, it makes plausible deniability for anyone using Taproot. As soon as you use Taproot, as soon as you have a Schnorr public key and a Schnorr signature, you could potentially maybe do an atomic swap to any other place, to any other transaction in the Bitcoin time chain, within the same block, within the same difficulty adjustment, or over the next halvening. It is absolutely not possible on the cryptographic level of the scripts to find out where you might have done a swap, or if you have done a swap at all. So all of a sudden, just by using Taproot alone, not even by using scriptless script atomic swaps, you get plausible deniability that your inputs do not pay your outputs within the same transaction.
Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't quite realize how big that disconnect actually was. Like how big the gap between what we know now and what we can essentially not know, that even a normal transaction using Taproot you can basically say it's like, well, you know, this was an atomic swap. None of these outputs are mine. That's exactly. That is disconnected. Just that's God damn it. That's crazy. So with the whole like wrapping pay to endpoint in this, we can essentially like, let's say I'm making an atomic swap and paying someone, but I want to atomic swap with someone else to pay to this. Well, we can also adding pay to endpoint in this means that we can also have the receiver, you know, consolidate a UTXO in this so that the actual payment is hidden within what looks like two just generic change amounts, essentially, like just remainders, but that there's this hidden payment in the middle, like that one Bitcoin that we talked about for the extremely expensive coffee earlier. we can exactly. Do that as part of the atomic swap.
Yes. And the goal here is to obfuscate the amounts. Because what if Alice wants to swap with Bob exactly 6.15 Bitcoin, right? Then we have a setup transaction worth 6.15 Bitcoin, and we have a redeem transaction of 6.15 Bitcoin. And then we can do something similar, a bit more difficult than CoinJoin Sudoku, to find out which setup transaction swapped with which redeem transaction. And this then makes the entire thing again traceable, right? We are no longer traced by the scripts that we use because we use scriptless scripts, but we are still traced by using precise denominations in our swap. And, you know, to be honest, I still have to do much more research on if this actually works or if my logic here is broken. But I think that by using a pay to endpoint, we can hide the exact value being transacted in the scriptless script, in the atomic swap itself, so that the value of the setup transaction is completely different to the value of the redeem transaction.
Interesting. And then basically you can have that, rather than just paying that atomic swap back to yourself, you can have that be your payment into a zero link transaction, into a zero link coin join, and have the coordinator work with that. And even where and what you've done is you've broken the origins of the coins, even going into the zero link coin join, because you've done a blind atomic swap on chain to get there.
Precisely.
And that combining multiple people's input. Holy shit, this is so complex, but fascinating.
It's crazy. And it's exactly as you say, right? So Alice has the Coinbase KYC coin, and she swaps that with Bob. And she gets not just any random redeem transaction, but her redeem transaction is a zero-link coin join. So she swaps into a zero-link coin join in a way that on-chain, it just looks like she does a one-input, one-output transaction to Bob, right? And she gets, this way, she can be part of a zero-link coin join without revealing this to her premix coin. And then she gets all the anonymity set of her of the zero-link coin join. And she can use the output of the zero-link coin join to do another atomic UTXO swap into the next zero-link coin join. And maybe she uses this zero-link coin join to open a Lightning Network Channel Factory, which is basically another huge coin join opening for Lightning Network Channel Factories, to then use the Lightning Network without anyone ever knowing that she actually used her Coinbase coin in order to fund that Lightning Network Channel Factory.
And what's most beautiful about that is when you like opening up like channels or channel factories, is that that's actually a situation where it could make a lot of sense to use equal denomination of coins in your channels, because once we get things like amps where we can aggregate amongst like multiple channels and stuff, that will not be a limitation on like how you can spend your coins. Whereas in the heuristic for like blockchain data, you know, if you're spending from multiple different, let's say you've got like five different 0.1 Bitcoin UTXOs, like addresses, and you want to spend 0.4 Bitcoin, Well, then if you're doing that on chain, well, then you reveal that all 0.4 of those are yours, even though in this instance, you've disconnected yourself pretty powerfully from where you actually got those on Coinbase. In the instance where you're doing that on Lightning, you've connected none of that together because you've used four separate channels. You've kept those separate, but you're still able to spend the entire 0.4 together at once through something like AMPS and technology that's going to make that more powerful.
Exactly. Right. And the thing with Lightning Network is it is based on hash time lock contracts, right? We commit to a secret, mm-hmm. we do something, we reveal the secret, something happens. Now we can do the same in a much more privacy preserving way. So atomic multipart payments actually become private because there's cryptographically no way to linking the different routes being part of the same economic transaction, right? So the entire Lightning Network is going to change when we have Taproot and Schnorr signatures and all the magic that we can do with this linear cryptography, plus together Zcash no input, which I know you talk about on the show as well. Mm-hmm. That together, like when we have L2 with scriptless scripts, we will just have phenomenal possibilities of providing very, very private transactions.
God, this is going to be crazy. What's most amazing to me about this is that the infrastructure that the Lightning Network is setting up is like this becomes a perfect always online network to coordinate all of this shit. Exactly. And that's one of the most amazing tools here is that we're setting up a infrastructure for always online devices that are specifically designed around setting up HTLCs and shared secrets and joint transactions to pay micro fees to aggregate exactly this sort of data and coordination between many different parties. Now we've got, now we've got encrypted communication happening over this so that what we can coordinate, what data we can share to make these sorts of things happen is really limited by our imagination. And that's basically it. I had a big blocker tell me the other day that there's no development happening on Bitcoin. And all I can think is how much I can't follow all of the development because it's so screaming fast. It blows my mind that someone can have that interpretation of what's going on and be missing an utter ocean of shit that is happening with all of these
nothing
tools.
Is happening. Move along. These are not the droids you're looking for.
But buy your shit coin, please. Stack whatever the hell you got, because we're busy. God, that's amazing.
Exactly.
This is so crazy.
One additional thing that we can do with this that is just another whole mind blow in and of itself, and that is something that I'm very, very interested in because it fits very well with the Zero-Link coordinator user setup. And so it's interesting for Wasabi Wallet, and I'm doing a lot of research on how we might be able to implement this specifically. That is something called partially blind atomic swaps. Okay. So basically, we have somewhat like a zero-link coordinator, this being, for example, the CK Snacks company, right, who runs the Wasabi Wallet coordinator. And here, CK Snacks, the service provider, has many, many, many inputs and many coins. And CK Snacks is willing to swap these coins with all the many users that we have. So there's Alice, Bob, Charlie, and all of them individually have their own coins, right? Alice bought on Coinbase, Bob is a agorist selling weed on Silk Road, and Charlie is, he gets his salary by, being a free software contributor. All these three want to swap individually their coins, not between each other, so Alice doesn't swap with Bob, but Alice swaps her coins with the coins of the coordinator, Bob swaps his coins with the coins of the coordinator, and Charlie also swaps the coins with the coordinator. But in a way that the redeemed transaction, the coordinator cannot tell whether it is Alice redeeming the coin, whether it is Bob redeeming the coin, or whether it is Charlie redeeming the coin. So even the coordinator here, the service provider, cannot de-anonymize the user on which on which redeem transaction were done by which user. So we again have a zero link that within the anonymity set of all users of a given time period, even the coordinator cannot link which transactions were used by whatever swap partner. So we increase the anonymity set again infinitely because we now have a zero link, not just in the output, but in the entire transaction that the users were part of.
Wow. This is nuts. What's the end game here that you see? Like how do you see the future of utilizing Bitcoin, like UTXOs? Like, do you think privacy, like some of these privacy mechanisms and stuff are going to be the default every time you open or close channels? On that note, actually, is there actually a cost savings to do something like, I mean, I know there's obviously cost savings to opening a Lightning channel with Taproot, which actually is going to be, thinking about recently, is that we're going to have no idea what the hell is going on Lightning Network, because that's our only way to judge how many damn channels and nodes there are, or not nodes, but how many channels there are on Lightning is by looking at the explicit opening and closing transactions on the on Bitcoin, and we won't be able to see any of that shit anymore. So that's going to be an interesting problem. But are there cost savings in doing this, or is this all if I did multiple example? Let's say we do a pay to endpoint where both parties are both consolidating UTXO. And they're both using it to open channels. Is that actually cheaper on top of being more private than opening a channel a normal way with a Taproot separately? Or do you know?
So with pay to endpoint, we have the scalability and thus block space usage and thus cost benefits that we consolidate. So we don't have a growth in our UTXO set and we save one transaction. So there is less block space being used within one transaction, and there are less transactions being used entirely. So that is a great scalability win. And the beautiful thing with all these very, very crazy sounding Taproot constructions is that in the cooperative case, which is most of the time, right? Most of the time, everyone plays along, especially when incentives are aligned. So in the cooperative case, everything is one public key and one signature, and that's it, right? There's nothing else. It does not matter how elaborate your script gets, how many peers you have in your CoinSwap channel factory openings, right? If everyone plays along, one pub key, one signature. So it is as cheap as using any other single signature spend. Doesn't matter if it's a 700 out of 1,000 multi-signature, it's just one pub key, one signature. Where the costs, of course, come in the uncooperative case. So, for example, if Alice does the setup transaction and then Bob goes offline, right? Then Alice has to wait for the timeout and she has to send her timeout transaction, and she might have to reveal some part of her Taproot script path that has the second or third order spending condition. Then we have again costs, right? The costs are much lower, because it is not the entire possible set of scripts that protect
just
this
the
UTXO.
Path
exactly.
Important. Yeah.
So it's still many, many benefits. Especially for more advanced scripts, and especially in the cooperative case.
This is so crazy. There's going to be so many, these little building blocks. It's one of those things, like trying to imagine the impact and the different ways this is going to be used is so incredibly difficult, because it's like trying to, you know, like when somebody was talking about HTLCs and, you know, time locking Bitcoin and having like a multi-signature account, it's like trying to imagine Lightning. Like, it's not by any means like intuitive or obvious from that. It's an incredibly complex architecture from very simple building blocks. And the number of new building blocks and little impacts that are being made with these pay to endpoint, aggregating just in a couple of different people, Taproot for opening a channel, Taproot for basically anything. And the fact that the cooperative close is invariably going to be 99% of the time, because there's no, unless somebody has literally just gone offline, is not available to sign anymore, there's no benefit for them to make, to have an uncooperative close, because the rightful owner always has the proof of ownership, always has the exact path that my output is the final destination. And the number of ways that this is going to be used to like solve problems, it truly is going to be just a whole new internet of solving financial problems, as opposed to communication problems in a sense. And it's just this, I can't get over, I'm constantly blown away by all of this shit.
And yeah, it physically hurts getting your mind blown that much. I'm very sorry to all the listeners. Please don't sue us for health concerns.
So many headaches induced. I saw your you've got your pinned tweet or whatever up at the top of cutting up one of your cards. Are you full on Bitcoin now? Are you living full on in the crypto economy, like 100%?
Yeah, so I said earlier that after UASF and O2X, I sold the last of my fiat bags. I still had some fiat income. Now, for several months now, I no longer have any fiat income as well. And for now, yeah, since October, so like middle of September, I no longer have a bank account. So I am completely unbanked. I never had credit cards. What I cut up there is a debit card, which I use to get cash out as soon as the salary hit. So right now I have Bitcoin income, I have Bitcoin hodlings, and I have Bitcoin expenses.
What are your, that's amazing. What are your number, like what are your three top tools that make that possible? How do you get around in legacy world by only navigating finance in the crypto economy here?
I mean, anything you want to buy in cyberspace, you can get with Bitcoin. Most of the time, service providers, you know, accept Bitcoin directly. There are services like, for example, Bitrefill or CoinCards that give you gift cards in exchange for Bitcoin. And you can use them on Amazon, on Zalando, on Airbnb, on pretty much whatever service you can come up with. There's most likely a gift card that you can use. So anything in cyberspace, you can get for Bitcoin directly. And many things in meat space, you can get in for Bitcoin if you talk to the entrepreneur providing the good or service directly. So for me, for many months or for many years now, I've been getting my food at local farmers markets. You know, we have them, you know, in Europe quite a bit, or you go directly to the farmer, onto their farm itself, to trade with them. And you know, most of them are private property defenders, and they understand the value of sound money, and they will most likely accept gold and Bitcoin if you ask them, and if you show them the benefits. And that is how I get most of my food.
Wow.
And then, you know, also for the few expenses that you then still have after hodling as much as possible and decreasing your consumption, get fiat Funcoin coins. So, you know, the fiat shitcoin has their paper utility token. It's like a gift card. Get exactly the amount that you need, and buy exactly that amount with Bitcoin in a local peer-to-peer trade. Right? Go to Bitcoin meetups, shill Bitcoin like crazy. And then you have your fun coupons and you get rid of them as fast as possible.
Your boomer bucks.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, we're an hour and 45. What is it? Is it midnight there? Midnight 15 already?
Yep.
Okay. Well, what are some final thoughts you want to leave the audience on this? Like maybe your thoughts on Lightning, the future of Bitcoin. Do you think, does all of this make you think that privacy is going to be a default, like that we're going to pull this off and basically have the cypherpunk vision that we always wanted? How do you see this playing out in the future?
We certainly have a phenomenal opportunity here. We have great tools at our disposal. And if you are in the need to protecting yourself and your property, then you can use these tools. They do have a cost. Most of the cost is in your own education. So accumulate as much knowledge as possible. And by listening to Guy's podcast here, you are already doing very, very good steps in that direction. And ultimately, you know, the biggest mistake that you can make is not using these tools. They are infinitely better than the incumbent fiat system. It doesn't matter how bad your coin control or coin management is in Bitcoin. It is infinitely better than using fiat. So get rid of your bank account and, you know, build this economy. This is not just something that will just happen out of nothing. This is something that we have to build with blood, sweat, and tears. So be active, contribute to the free software projects that you actually use. All the projects that I've contributed to, I am a personal user for many months. I need this shit. That is why I have to make sure that it becomes better. I'm not doing this for someone else. I'm scratching my own itch. Like, I need my cold card. I need my noddle. I need my wasabi. Like, so this is, you know, find out what you're interested in, what you really need, and then find out how you can contribute. Again, I can't code. I'm a complete noob. But still, you know, I can do education. I can do high level concept design. I can just be active and help out and shill like crazy, so that other peers can get this technology as well.
Nice. It's funny. I'm finally diving into Rodolfo. Is sending me donated a cold card, and I'm really excited about that because it's the only hardware wallet that I actually don't have yet. I managed to get a ledger at the a new ledger to play around with at Bitcoin 2020, and then a friend sent me a deal to get a Keep Key for free. So I've got like all the main ones except for Cold Card. And I have actually set up Wasabi Wallet a couple of weeks ago, but I have not actually utilized it for anything because I wanted to connect it to a hardware wallet. And my thought was, oh, I should get a Cold Card for this. So fingers crossed, I'm waiting to get that soon, I hope.
Yeah, so I love both Cold Card. I have all three marks, like all three versions. And, you know, I love Wasabi as well. And that was, for example, that is one way that I could contribute to both projects, was getting them together, right? Adam Fisco was contemplating on implementing hardware wallet support in Wasabi, and he decided against it because he did not want to deal with the hassle of implementing hundreds of different hardware wallet versions. And so mm-hmm. I told him about Andrew Chow's project of the hardware wallet interface. That kind of packages all the dependencies that you need for all the different hardware wallets and puts them into one very easy to use binary file. And so we implemented HWI in Wasabi Wallet, which now means that you can connect any hardware wallet pretty much to Wasabi Wallet and use them to securely sign your transactions offline. And especially I've made sure that the cold card implementation is on fleek. So it works with PSBT. You can do offline transferring of the partially signed Bitcoin transactions over SD card and broadcast it securely while still having all the privacy benefits on the network level of Wasabi using BIP-158 block filters over Tor and having the superb coin control and coin labeling and all this. So the two projects go very well together in hand. I mean, if you want to use the multisig, then you use Electrum together with your own Electrum personal server. Both of the wallets are fantastic. And, you know, it's one way of getting all these projects together and making sure that we really have this full stack of weapons of self-defense.
Nice. And you basically have tutorials for all that shit, right?
Yep.
Awesome. Well, how does everybody find you? I find your tutorials, your work, all the stuff.
So my personal website is towardsliberty.com. And there again, like the archive of knowledge of Bitcoin, Austrian economics, and just philosophy in general, as well as all the videos. The videos are on the World Crypto Network hosted. And it's like an ancient YouTube channel that has, I think, by now over 3,000 videos on Bitcoin since 2012 or 13. Yeah, ancient stuff. More on GitHub, like especially the Wasabi Wallet GitHub. You know, trying to review as much as possible and make sure that not too many bugs are introduced, and, you know, opening feature requests so that the devs know what to work on. That's awesome. If you cannot code, you tell the coders what to do, which is very nice.
Yeah, awesome.
And maybe one thing, like specifically for Taproot, This is right now in the proposal and in the review stage, right? So Taproot was introduced in early 2016. There's a BIP a draft BIP of BIP-Schnorr, BIP-Taproot, and BIP-TapScript. And they are right now under heavy, heavy peer review. There have already been many revisions, and there is specifically, organized by Anthony Towns, AJ, the BIP-Taproot review club that is hosted on IRC, on Slack, on Hangouts, on Zoom, on many platforms. I think over 160 participants trying to break this and trying to figure out how we can improve it. I can highly, highly recommend you joining us there. It is in part together with the Bitcoin Optech, which have a phenomenal, a truly, truly phenomenal workshop on BIP Taproot that is also hosted on their GitHub, of course, free and open source. So I can very, very, very much recommend you all to at least read the BIPs, to get educated, to somehow find out how we can further improve this. And the cool thing is that since this 1 week of the BIP review club, we already have, I think, 3 or 4 merged pull requests to the BIP repository that fix some minor details. So this is really something that we can change. And again, like, one of these PRs was from me. I cannot code whatsoever. I'm a complete noob in most of this, and I can still contribute to cutting edge spaceship software like Bitcoin Core. So don't be shy. This really is something where we need as much help as possible. And ultimately, these are tools that you want to use. I mean, it's a phenomenal tool. And if you want to make sure that the tool that you use is properly designed and implemented, then you really have to contribute and make sure that it actually is. So I can only recommend be active, get educated, and ultimately contribute.
Nice, nice. Do you have the link to that group? I would love to lurk and just kind of soak up information in that group, and maybe be of help if I could.
Oh yes, for sure. So that is the three BIPs are BIP-Schnorr, BIP-Taproot, and BIP-TapScript. They're on github.com/SIPA, which is the repository of Peter Woolley, /BIPs. Okay. Then there is the Bitcoin Ops Taproot Workshop at github.com/BitcoinOps/Taproot-Workshop. And there is then also, where's the study group? One second, that is AJ Towns. Has AJ Towns /Taproot-review, and here are many contributors getting together on IRC. There are like 3 or 4 study groups, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 study groups just on IRC. Another 5 of them on Slack, 1 on Zoom,
wow.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7 on Hangout. And a bunch of others. So again, it's a lot of fun. Reach out to your peers. Be active on Twitter. Hashtag Taproot, and make sure that this is not broken.
That is awesome. That is really awesome. We will sort out all those links, and I'll try to have all of this available in the show notes and a place where they can go and donate, and find you and all the awesome work that you're doing. And I just want to say thanks for coming on the show, man. I've been following you for a long time, and it really is amazing what you put out, and you're an awesome resource to have in this space. And I also love that you're a fellow hardcore Austrian economics. The more people we have with that fundamental, working from the axioms of the real world, I think have a clearer idea of where we need to be for the future and what we need to build to make that possible without all the Keynesian distortions that screw up our concepts of balance and sustainability here.
Absolutely, man. 100 years of fiat culture have fucked up us pretty much. A bunch of resources misallocated. We have to put that right. It's going to be painful. It's going to be a lot of hard work, but ultimately, good resource allocation is vitally important. So Bitcoin fixes this. Guy, thank you very much. Also for you, I can give the compliment very much back. I cannot count the many, many hours that I've spent in the forest walking with the dog while listening to your readings. Your podcasts are very awesome, a great, great, great resource to have. And also the commentary is something that I very much appreciate. You know, because reading the articles is one thing, but then having the additional, you know, little tidbits, little additional information, just to get a whole picture, and you know, you understand especially your Austrian economics and your Bitcoin concepts as well. So very much appreciated. You know, sharing the knowledge, raising your peers is vitally important in this fight. So thank you for all that, and especially also thank you for the invitation. It was very fun talking to you. Great questions, as always. And you know, keep up the great work.
Awesome, man. I appreciate it. All right, we will close this one out here. Thank you, everybody. Do not forget to check out Max. We'll have all the links and everything available in the show notes. And of course, I'll try to drop as much of the shit as possible in the Twitter. So thanks so much, man. To have a good night, get some sleep, and enjoy Taiwan.
Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Later. All right. We are going to have all this stuff available, all these links available in the show notes so that you can explore. Don't forget his site, if you don't go to the show notes, is towardsliberty.com, and he has so much stuff to explore up there. He even goes through like what has government done to our money, and a bunch of stuff in ethics of money production. There is literally a tons of stuff to explore up there. So, one last thank you to Max for such an awesome chat. Drop us a line on Twitter. Tell us what you thought. And thank you all for listening to The Crypto Economy. Your homework for today is to follow Max. And if you are not following Max, your score is automatically below 6.15, which means you're failing. For extra credit, you can follow me and retweet this episode. And for a warm and loving thank you, you can subscribe to The Crypto Economy. I've got some really great stuff lined up for the rest of the week. So subscribe and stay tuned, and I'll catch you all tomorrow. Until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.